now.
Sorry, my girlfriend's dog is humping a stuffed animal.
Welcome to episode 55 of There Is No Offseason, a podcast from Baseball Prospectus focusing solely on Fantasy Keeper and Dynasty League formats. I am your host, Ben Carsley, and I am joined by BP's fantasy manager and epic humble bragger, Brett Sayer, and my fellow authors, the man of 1,000 fantasy podcasts, Mauricio Rubio, and okay-ish fruit ranker, Craig Goldstein. Hello, everyone. Say hi and tell people where they can find you on the interwebs, and Brett will start with you.
You can find me at baseballprospectus.com and thedynastyguru.com and on Twitter at dynastyguru. Mal?
You can find me at baseballprospectus. You can find me on Twitter at mrubio52. Craig?
You can find me at baseballprospectus, at thedynastyguru, at foxsports.mlb, and you can find me on Twitter at cdgoldstein. That's CD as in classic dude. Goldstein. Ben?
Excellent. You can also find me at Baseball Prospectus, and you can find me at BP Boston. You can find me on Twitter at Ben Carsley, and this podcast on Twitter via the aptly named at Tino Podcast handle. Also like us on Facebook at There Is No Offseason, and ask us questions and tell us about your feelings by emailing us at tinopodcast@gmail.com. So the season is winding down, especially from a dynasty perspective, because pretty soon we're not going to have any new minor league information to relay to you. So naturally, when we were brainstorming, what type of series we could bring you guys every 7 or 8 weeks when we do record Tino, we decided we would just do a pure value-based system in terms of here are guys that have performed exceptionally this year or exceptionally poorly, and do we buy into the hype? Because we are capable of not doing entire themes by position, that's how I'll be breaking it down, so you have that to look forward to in the second half of the podcast tonight. But first, we are going to do something pretty crazy. We've never done it before. We're going to start with reader emails. And the first reader email this time around is from Pete. Pete says, "Hey guys, I'll spare you the details of my weird format 4x4 AL-only league, but I'm looking for help on filling out a keeper slot. I'll have the opportunity to pick up one of the following players in September and keep him for a max of 3 years. Can you rank or tier these players based on a mix of impact and when you project they might stick with the big club? Given the 3-year max, the chance of challenging for a spot on the opening day roster or a pre-All-Star break call-up certainly has value. Aaron Judge, Nomar Mazara, Tim Anderson, Jose Berrios, Bradley Zimmer, Manny Margot, and Mark Appel. Thanks, Pete." So, Craig, because this question has both Judge and Mazara, it definitely needs to go to you first. But before you answer, please speak to how awful of a league format this is.
Well, I think he's spared us even the weirdness of it all, right? It is what he's saying. But the 4x4 AL only, that's the original fantasy league. Is that incorrect?
Well, the original fantasy league was 4x4 NL only, but yeah.
Well,
it's this format with wins and no strikeouts and with no runs scored. Yeah, that's a pretty
standard. That being said, innovation came around for a good reason.
Because yeah.
I hate the 4x4. Even if it's just adding runs and strikeouts, like I far prefer that to a 4x4.
I just I want to tease this a little bit. If you're listening, this is far and away not the worst format we're going to discuss in reader questions.
Yeah. That one is definitely tougher.
Yeah.
Okay, so I don't think that – first and foremost, I don't think that Tim Anderson really enters this discussion just because there's going to be a premium put on contribution early next year. I think I think you can probably say the same for Margot and to a certain extent Zimmer, just because they're not going to be, you know, be contributing, at least in my assumption, until the latter part stages of 2016 or maybe even at all in 2016, in the case of someone like Margot. Now, I would probably limit my selections to Judge, Mazzara, and Berrios, and I would probably go with Mazzara, Berrios, Judge in that order. I do think that Mazzara will be the last of those three to make an appearance, but I do also think that he's not going to. I think he might. He's definitely going to need to make adjustments once he hits the majors, but I think he can be productive while making those adjustments, whether it's, you know, hitting for average but not for power at the start, or possibly vice versa. I think he's probably the best blend of those things and the guy I would want to put my shares into. I put Berrios second because I think Berrios should be pitching for the Twins right now. They're starting something called the Tyler Duffy. Well, holding the second wild card spot right now. So I'm not sure why Berrios isn't pitching for them, but I think he will be pitching for them basically as soon as the well, it's not Super 2, but as soon as they gain an extra year of control in April, assuming that he doesn't come up later this year. Brett, do you have a different read on it?
I think that given the format and given the time frame, I think I'd have a slightly different list, but not much. I think I would actually take the three outfielders. I would take Judge, Mazzara, and Zimmer. This is why. I think Berrios has a fair amount of value in strikeouts, which doesn't count here. And
you're
I think
right.
Relying on pitchers to come up right away and contribute heavily in ratios, which is what you really expect them to do in these 4x4 leagues, I think it's asking a little too much of Berrios. And I really
you're
like,
right. I defaulted to normal analysis without, you know, just like my brain does not compute when dropping out strikeouts from a fantasy league. Like, they, you know, they're so essential that it doesn't make sense. I think that's a great point, but go ahead.
Yeah. I think Berrios and Zimmer are really close to each other in a 5x5. I'd probably lean Berrios in a 5x5, but it's, I could go back and forth depending on the day. You know, the thing that kind of stinks about this time frame is that Anderson I think has great upside. I think he's absolutely not one of the three people here, but when he does get up, he's going to be really valuable in this kind of league because, one, nobody will care if he gets on base, and two, he's going to steal bases, and stolen bases are more valuable in a 4x4 than they are in a 5x5. But I think, you know, I think Zimmer's going to be up. I think Zimmer's going to be up before Super 2 deadline next year. I think he's going to be up quicker than we think. Cleveland has an awful outfield, and I think they're going to fancy themselves a contender next year. Whether they're right or wrong depends on a whole bunch of things that we probably don't want to get into right now. But I don't see them waiting all that long to throw Zimmer into the fire unless they make some sort of weird free agent splash in the offseason that I don't expect.
Yeah, the only thing that I would say in that respect is that Tyler Naquin is probably serviceable, at least enough to get them to halfway through the year or so.
Yeah, he might be.
Right, probably. Yeah. There's definitely the potential that he comes up, bombs, and they need to make a move.
Yep. But then again, I mean, Jose Ramirez came up and bombed, and they didn't. The Indians didn't go to Lindor, so.
Right. That might. Right.
All right. So I have a question, and Mal, feel free to jump in here too. Aaron Judge isn't the first choice for either of you, it seems. Is that at all because of his struggles in AAA? Are you banking on the Yankees acquiring more outfield help this offseason? Why is he not atop the list? Because he already is in AAA, and his power in that park is pretty tempting.
Well, Mazzara's already got some plate appearances in AAA as well, and he was in AA for most of the year. I see where they come from in preferring Mazzara to Judge because the upside is higher in when it comes to the bat in terms of both batting average. And you know, they're close in home run production. You know, a Judge comes out ahead there, but... you know, I think that when you're really looking at it, yeah, Judge is certainly in consideration for being on top of this list. But it's not like Mazzara is particularly far behind when it comes to the developmental curve. So, you know, there's more adjustments, as Craig alluded to, for Mazzara to make. But if you're going to really gamble on one of these guys, and it does kind of sound like it's going to be, you know, just kind of like almost like a flyer. You know, I think Mazzara is the pick here over Judge for sure. And I you can certainly make the case that you can make the outside case that Judge ahead of Mazzara, but I agree with Mazzara ahead of Judge.
I think, at least for me, and this is somewhat building on what Mao said, they are both at the same level. Obviously, Judge has about 40 more games at AAA than Mazzara, which isn't to be overlooked. But you know, he's struggled to hit for average there. He hasn't struggled to be productive exactly. So I'm not concerned about his performance at AAA. And I think he's someone who can take advantage of Yankee Stadium when he comes up there. You know, both are in favorable hitting environments. I think the Yankees certainly could address outfield, or it could just be a little more crowded. You know, Carlos Beltran has shown us he's not entirely dead. And they tend to cycle people throughout the DH spot. And if Ellsbury and Gardner are healthy, you know, that's a full outfield. And it might, you know, what he gets in being at the major league level might be mitigated in some sense in not being, you know, in playing in, you know, five of every seven games instead of seven of seven or whatever it would be. Mazzara has something of a clear path to playing time in Texas, barring any moves they make. And I like his blend a little better. And I think if you think that Judge is going to be up for, you know, if the 6 to 8 weeks Judge might be up earlier than Mazzara weighs really heavily for you, I totally can understand you wanting to go that route. But I think, you know, the moment that they're both in the majors, you'd automatically prefer Mazzara. And if that's the case, then, you know, 6 weeks probably isn't making or breaking the difference between their value.
Yeah, I totally agree. I'd go with Mazzara too. I just think it was good to vocalize.
No, I think, you know, saying why is definitely worthwhile.
Especially in, like, you know, an audio format like this. It's better.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. That was a pretty thorough breakdown. So we'll move on to the next question, which is all about an infrequently talked about young player named Chris Bryant. So this question comes from Brian, who says, as of today, Chris Bryant's splits are straight up silly. If he matched his road split to his home split, he'd not only be the rookie of the year, he'd at least be in the running for NL MVP with Harper and Goldschmidt. His home splits, 290, 398, 624, 17 homers, 46 RBI, 40 runs. Road, 230, 332, 335 with 3 homers, 29 RBI, and 30 runs. I'm not sure what to think about home road as there are glaring differences. Another funny thing about his splits is his performance under pressure. He's clearly better with runners on and runners in scoring position. Obviously, that is an extremely small sample size, but do you think this is fluky, or is it easier to believe that he'll make adjustments in the coming years to match his underperformance pressure as he's shown the ability to make necessary adjustments at every level to be truly elite, a la Harper and Goldie? Love the podcast, and I'd appreciate your thoughts. Mao, I'm giving this to you. It's funny, you know, we talk about these guys so much when they're prospects, and then oftentimes once they actually get to the bigs and, you know, they've been there for a month or so and they're producing, we sort of stop speaking about them as frequently. And I think that's happened a little bit to us with Bryant. So address Brian's question here, talk about splits, and then sort of speak to Brian's performance overall and if this is about what you were expecting this year.
I was talking to a scout in the off season. I think it was right before the season was started, as spring training was kind of wrapping up, and we were just kind of shooting the shit, and we got to talking about Bryant, and we both pretty much agreed that if Chris Bryant hit about 260 to 270 with 25 home runs, it would be a pretty incredible season. You know, because I think that a lot of people have gotten addicted to just early performances and early production on an almost obscene level when it comes to prospects and recent call-ups. I mean. You know, when you really look at Bryant's season in total, he's been, you know, completely ridiculous. Now, when you break it down as a split with, like, home road and all that stuff, like, I mean, yeah, it starts to look a little bit funny, but, again, like, these sample sizes are pretty small, and I really wouldn't put that much stock into it. I mean, this is a guy who's already shown the ability to make adjustments. When he first got called up, this is someone who was really rearing back and getting ready to hit the fastball because he knew he was going to get attacked with fastballs, especially with velocity inside on the hands. And it kind of left him exposed to changeups. Well, he started making the adjustment there and started being able to recognize bat spin off the plate and was putting himself into good at-bats and grinding out at-bats. And I mean, this is a really long way of putting it. Like, he's been making adjustments all season. So, you know, I don't want to make fun of you here, but, like, to kind of cherry pick the home road splits and to really get, you know, macro or micro when kind of picking him apart when it comes to situational stats, I just think you're thinking about it too hard. Like he's, you know, this is his first season. It's been a pretty tremendous debut, all things considered. And just enjoy it. Like he's good. He's shown the ability to make adjustments all year, and he's going to continue to make those adjustments because he's a smart cerebral hitter. And so, you know, he's got the ability to cover any of the weaknesses that he naturally has and that he'll develop as a result of adjustments. So I think you're thinking too hard. Anyone disagree?
Brett, when you look at Bryant's home splits, do you think that's sort of the type of player he could become on a routine basis moving forward? Is that his real upside showing?
I mean, sure, at absolute peak,
yes.
But I mean, it's fun to look at because, I mean, he's got a slugging percentage 300 points higher at home than on the road, and that's interesting to look at. But this doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean anything. Bryant is fantastic, and I think he's only going to get better from here. What's really the point of discussing some of the stuff, right? I mean, he's never going to be a kind of player you sit on the road and play at home. I mean, that's dumb. So yeah, just love Chris Bryant. That's all.
Yeah, I didn't think it was going to be, you know, people were going to start cherry picking it like that. Although I guess I should have expected it, but
I just need to say, like, use home road splits to inform your decision making about, like, when you might want to start a pitcher or a hitter, or, you know, going back to one of Brett's first article at BP, you know, like assembling a greater player out of two players who you aren't willing to start every day in a spot. But don't do this. Don't use home road splits to, like, worry about a player going forward. I mean, this is just not, like, he's Chris Bryant. He's an elite level talent. And whether he hits 230, 332, 335 on the road in his rookie year is not predictive at all. And it's just like, it's, as you said, it's a small sample size. It's not enough games. And breaking it down into runners on and not, it's just like, this is going way, way too deep. Like, just zoom out a little bit and appreciate the player as a whole. You're not going to be sitting him for the most part. And, you know, this type of, like, the worrying about the home road splits stuff is just completely unnecessary.
Yeah, to be fair to the email to Brian, this wasn't like a panic. Oh no! Look at his road.
No. I'm speaking more in general. Yes, yeah, you're right. Yeah. That was hard on Bryant, and I didn't mean to be.
I mean, fuck you, Bryant. But still.
But Ben's words, not mine. But yeah, but just in general, like, this isn't necessarily an uncommon kind of tack to take. You know,
not at all. Okay. Let's move away from home road split related fantasy questions, shall we?
Sure.
Okay.
Are we going to get to talk about a good format or a bad format?
Oh, this is pretty special. This is... I know we haven't had weird fucking format of the week in a while, but this makes up for all the weeks we've missed.
This isn't weird as weird so much as it is sad.
That's true. Okay. this is the Sarah McLaughlin commercial of AL only formats. Okay.
Oh, God.
This email is from Jason. Jason says, "Hey guys, I love the work that you do and thanks for all the entertainment. I'm in a very competitive 13-team 5x5 AL only keeper league with a $260 cap, and I'm wondering what arms I should be protecting next year. In our league, you get to keep the players for 2 years, and in the beginning of the third year, you have to make the decision to then extend the contract of the player at the value they were drafted for $5 per year. I am allowed to protect up to 15 players in total, along with 5 minor leaguers, and I have what I think is a glut of pitching. We play 14 hitters and 9 pitchers at all times, meaning no weekly benching. Which of these pitchers would you project heading into next season, if any? Matt Boyd at $2, Yu Darvish at $17, Ivan Nova at $3, Henry Owens at $1, Carson Smith at $1, Sean Doolittle at $7, Vince Velasquez at $10, Kendall Graveman at $3. I already have in mind protecting Sonny Gray at $6, Betances at $11, Wade Davis at $7, Sean Tolleson proven closer at $1. So in theory, I could protect up to 5 more arms if I wanted to. My offense is putrid as I was playing for next year. My only offense products will be James McCann at $2 because it's a 2-catcher league. James Loney at $5, Delino DeShields at $6, Eddie Rosario at $2, and Mark Canna at $2. I know I have to package my pitching for much better bats, but need a little guidance on who to keep first. I know I am not as funny as Meepits, and I didn't ask you if you had to be a sandwich, but thanks for taking a look at my questions, Jason." So once again, 13-team, 5x5, AL-only keeper with a $260 cap, no bench spots, and 2 goddamn starting catchers. That might be the worst format we've ever had.
Any format where you have to start Giovanni Soto is the worst format.
26 starting catchers in an AL-only league.
Yeah.
I'm speechless.
Okay.
I have a 10... horrible.
This is rough.
How do we recover from that? Like, what do we do?
I will repeat these prices once more for our listeners since we sort of breezed through them. So the players he's asking about keeping are Boyd at $2, Darvish at $17, Nova at $3, Owens or Smith at $1, Sean Doolittle at $7, Velasquez at $10, Graveman at $3. Would you be keeping any of these players? Would you be moving on? Would you already have killed yourself after realizing what this league format means? What are your thoughts?
I think most of these are keepable players. I'm not much of a Matt Boyd guy, so I'd throw him back. And I don't think Doolittle is someone who I would keep at $7. I don't trust him. Beyond that, I think everyone's keepable at these prices. I mean, they're pretty minimal. Velasquez, I think, is borderline at $10. That might be a little expensive depending on how much inflation there is in the league. But he's got some upside. I like that. But the offense is just horrible. I mean, that's just bad. I mean, even in a deep AL only league, that's bad.
It doesn't really matter what he does with the pitching.
No.
Yeah, you're not
winning. No, not for next year. No, he's got some work to do in the auction.
I mean, I think you have to keep some of these. Like, I think you have to keep in this league. You have to keep Owens, Smith, Nova.
Yeah,
like those. At those prices, like just a decent starting pitcher, which Nova and Owens probably will be, are worth a lot. And I know he's keeping a bunch of relievers already, but I mean, trade some of your relievers.
Yeah, for anyone who can hit, trade a reliever.
If you have Davis, you have Tolleson. I guess it's only one real closer, right? Because Betances and Davis aren't necessarily closing.
Well, Davis will be.
Yeah, Holland's
Davis.
Is Holland a free? Okay, I couldn't remember if he had one more year.
Davis is a free agent too, isn't he?
Is he?
I think he is, yeah.
Mm. Well, I'll still be.
So you might not have Wade Davis. He might go to the NL.
This is also true.
So, I mean, I would also probably keep Velasquez. I think he's definitely got enough upside to justify the cost, though it is a little pricey. But you have to keep the most talent and see if you can spin that talent for bats. And I'd probably keep Darvish. I would keep Boyd or Graveman, personally.
I would definitely keep Darvish.
So I think, you know, of the guys he listed, Boyd and Graveman are the top and the bottom. I'd keep everyone in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and not Doolittle. I'm sorry. I missed Doolittle.
Mao, any deep thoughts?
No, I passed out. As long as that
Okay, so my question is, in a 13-team AL-only league where you have to start four Irish singers from the early 90s, would you start Enya?
No, I'd start the dude from Riverdance, even though he doesn't sing.
Ooh.
Strong play.
Patrick Flatley.
Yeah, there we go. Patrick
that Flatley. You know? How do you know?
That I know. How do you forget? How do you not know?
Oh, God, easily.
Do we know what Sinead O'Connor's eligibility is?
Why are we going so deep with Irish singers from the 90s?
I mean, are we? I think we're out.
Yeah, that's about it, right? Wait, yeah. Bono? No, wait. Yeah.
Bono, really?
Bono.
We're talking now. We're talking about Enya.
Welcome back to episode 55 of Tino. I hope you used that break to do some research as to early 90s Irish singers that you enjoy. So as I rambled through in the early moments of this edition of Tino, now we're going to start a series that doesn't really have a name. Basically, what we're just trying to do is bring you players who have really surpassed expectations or fallen short of expectations, tell you what we think about these performances, and sort of how we're starting to view these players in the context of 2016 and beyond. We wrestled with a few different ways as to how we could present this to you, but we think sticking with positions is just the best. So basically what we're doing, we have an internal email chain. For each position, we're just sending around names of players who, as I said, have done really well or really poorly compared to expectations, picking the four or five who are most interesting at each position and discussing them for you here. So bear with us as we get our sea legs for the sea legs just made me think of my Tom Rinaldi joke. But bear with us as we sort of get this under our feet for now, and hopefully this will be smoother as we go along. So to start, let's go with catcher, and let's go with Steven Vogt, who is having a very impressive year, hitting .261, .342, .449, 16 homers, 63 RBI, 49 runs. Right now, he is currently the fifth best fantasy catcher in standard 5x5 leagues per ESPN's player rater. Craig, we will start with you. Is Vogt real, and do you think he will be a top 10 option next year?
He's not this real, which it's something of a cop-out answer, but I don't think he's, like you said, number five on the player radar reel. And I think he's definitely come back to earth, you know, as the season's gone along. But that being said, he's obviously not without talent at the plate. I think he's, you know, in June and August, he's been closer to .750 in terms of OPS. I think that's probably reasonable. And I also think that is probably squeezed out of the top 10. So I'm going to say no.
Top 15?
Yeah, probably so.
Okay. Brett, do you feel the same? Do you feel differently?
No, I'm going to say yes to top 10, but it's going to be playing time based. I think The number looking at his stat line that really jumps out to me is the 117 games, and he's going to play, and he's going to come close to 150 games by the end of the year, and I think he can do the same thing next year. Oakland likes to kind of mix and match him a little bit at different spots. He's played mostly first base. He's played 21 games at first, 7 games at DH. He's played one game in the outfield. Or no, that was last year. So he hasn't played in the outfield this year. I think with the additional at bats that he'll get from the extra 10 to 15 games he might play over an average catcher, I think the counting stats will buoy him into the top 10. I'd probably say he's around maybe 7 or 8-ish.
Mm-hmm. Seems reasonable. Mal?
Yeah, I'm gonna agree with Brett. I think he's gonna be in the back half of the top 10 because of playing time, and also, I mean, he does provide some value. He can hit a little bit, and he's shown that he can hit for moderate amount of power over the past two seasons when he does play. So, I feel like the back half of the top 10 catcher list is usually pretty interchangeable. So, I think he sneaks in back there in the top 10. It's not gonna be spectacular. It's not gonna be top 5, but he's a usable player for sure.
Yeah. Speaking of.
The only thing I would say in terms of playing time and how the A's use him is, and they, I agree with you, they'll play him all over and get him at bats, but he's consistently been a pretty poor hitter against lefties, and granted, that's the strong side of the platoon, but I don't know that I see 150 games as a reasonable bar.
Yeah, but I don't think the A's have anyone else to take that time away from him at catcher. I mean, I think it's useful to know for.
I mean, Josh Fagley's been pretty good.
It's Josh Fagley.
I mean, it's okay. Steven Vogt against lefties is a 650 OPS.
So. We just covered a league where Josh Fagley would be a third overall.
I have him in an AL only league.
Yeah, Fagley would be a really good second catcher in that league.
Right.
I'm going to say just outside of the top 10, also because I think there are a lot of catchers outside the top 10 right now who I think would recover next year. As I go through the top 10, the only names that make me scratch my head are Nick Hundley at 4, and then Cervelli at 8. But you have guys like Molina, Schwarber, Jonathan Lucroy, Wilson Ramos, Blake Swihart, Yan Gomes, a lot of guys who for various reasons aren't in the top 10 right now that I could easily see rebounding. So I don't think Vogt has the pure talent to match up with a lot of those. So I'm going to say closer to the 12 range with Craig.
And also I just to be obnoxious, for what it's worth, just league 2015 OPS, Steven Vogt is at 791 on the year. Josh Fagley's at 785. So you can say it's just Josh Fagley. I'll say it's just Steven Vogt.
The most Craig exchange ever. Okay, actually, so we just talked about Gomes, and he is next on our list. I know that he sort of sparked some disagreement between us early in the year, and of course, Brett was right, because he's an asshole. So Yan Gomes right now is hitting .223, .266, .362. Obviously, he missed a ton of time with injury this year. He currently ranks down at 31 in terms of top fantasy catchers. Mal, we'll go backwards and start with you. What's up with Yan Gomes, and do you think he's going to rebound to be a top 10 option next year?
Well, he's striking out a ton, I think that he's going to rebound, but I don't think he's going to be top 10. I think he's going to actually be in the top 12 range, 10 to 12 range. That when he was healthy last year, or when he was producing last year, the on-base percentage is already starting to trend downwards. He's never been someone who's had a lot of plate discipline. So I think that, he's going to rebound some. He's not going to be an absolute zero. He's not going to hit .230. But I don't really necessarily see him being a strong top 10 guy next year. Brett?
I don't see him as a top 10 guy. I've been historically the low man on Gomes, and I am willing to give him some benefit of the doubt for this year, but I don't see him being a top 10 option next year. The plate discipline is I think finally kind of, he kind of needs that he needs that batting average to buoy him. I mean, he's on pace for 15, 16 home runs, given a regular amount of playing time. But, you know, if that comes with a 240, 250 average, that puts him probably just outside, especially given that he'll probably score a very, very low number of runs. But yeah, I think he's just outside. I mean, I'd take Vogt over Gomes next year. I mean, I think it's a pretty interesting comparison. Ben, what about you?
I would probably take Gomes over Vogt next year. I think Gomes will also be right around the 11-12. That's a flip of coin for me. I've been a little higher on Gomes. I really like him. He is suffering from a 274 BABIP right now, which is not the end-all be-all, but it is down from 312 career mark. And, you know, I don't know if he's going to hit over 20 home runs every year like he did in 2014, but as you alluded to, the power is clearly still there. So do I think he's going to hit 294 like he did in 2013? No, but I think he's going to be closer to the 260, 270 range than I do the 250 range that you mentioned. Craig?
Yeah, I'm with you. And I think that if he gets the batting average up and we're not worried about the power, then we're probably talking about a back end of the top 10 catcher at least. So I don't see, he's also fought through an injury this year.
Yeah.
Which, you know, could be affecting his play, even though he's, you know, he's obviously back and or was affecting his play potentially. So I don't know. I would take Gomes over Vogt in a second. I don't think this year is representative of his talent. And like you said, with the BABIP, I mean, again, it's not everything, but, and it's possible he's earning it with soft contact, et cetera. But I think he can get healthy and get back on track and be, you know, a reasonable facsimile of 2014, which was a pretty good year. Possibly a few less homers, but.
Okay. Before we get into catching prospects, let's stay on the Brett was right train and talk about Wellington Castillo, who is only at 242, 313, 496, but has 17 homers and 43 RBI in only 284 plate appearances. Despite the lack of playing time, that is good for the 14th best fantasy catcher so far in 2015. Brett, is this really what you've been waiting to see from Castillo? Do you feel vindicated? Do you think this is reasonable moving forward?
I love it. Castillo, since he went to the Diamondbacks, is hitting 272, 349, 576 with 15 home runs in 55 games. It's definitely heavy on the power. I mean, even with Arizona, I don't think he's a, you know, 35 home run hitter as he's pacing for with the Diamondbacks. But I think in that environment, with the bulk of the playing time that he seems really likely to get at this point, I think he's a slightly better version of Yan Gomes.
Ugh.
I think he's got a touch more power. And I think the batting averages are similar, and he'll have better counting stats in Arizona. He'll be hitting, and he's been hitting fourth or fifth in that lineup lately. And the Diamondbacks don't have too many other guys that can slot into there. Hitting behind Paul Goldschmidt will give you an awful lot of RBI opportunities. I think he's a legit top 10 catcher for next year, and this is absolutely the reason why I'm glad that people have not forgotten about him.
I think you're insane.
Seconded.
I don't understand. Like, you're saying he has more, like, you think he's Yan Gomes with more power. He has a career 420 slugging percentage versus Gomes, 440. Like, that's not nothing. And he was mostly in Chicago, which is a solid place to hit. I mean, I just don't understand. I think that's being unduly influenced by the ridiculous power numbers he's putting up, that he's putting up in Arizona. I mean, I think if you wanted to tell me, I like Castillo. I mean, if you wanted to tell me he could do his 2013 that he had in Chicago, which was like eerily similar to what he's doing in Arizona, but for the power, I'm with you. But he's definitely more of like a 400 to 420 power guy than anything close to like a 490 guy, which is what you're talking about. Because Gomes has been at 472 and 481 in 2014 and 2013.
Yeah, but Gomes' slugging percentage isn't a true apples to apples.
Okay, he's better than him in ISO too.
It's the same thing. It Castillo doesn't have.
Well, no, Castillo slugging and ISO aren't the same thing.
Oh, here goes Craig.
No, they're not.
Well, it's still the gap between slugging and home runs. There's other things that make up slugging percentage, which shows up in both slugging percentage and ISO. Gomes is a guy who has power.
You didn't say.
This is the advanced analytics portion of the podcast where we explain what slugging percentage is, but go ahead.
I think Castillo's going to hit 20 plus home runs next year. The home runs that he's hitting, he looks the part. He looks like what he should have been 2 years ago, which is that 2013 version of him, but with more power.
Okay, we're clearly not going to get Brett and Craig to come to any sort of middle ground here. Mao, where do you weigh in on this?
I think he's going to be 2012 Wellington Castillo, which yeah, I guess splits the difference. He was a highly regarded offensive prospect when he was coming up through the Cubs system, and the defense was always lagging far behind the bat. And you know, Arizona doesn't really care about catcher defense, apparently. So
Doe.
Yeah, I think that he's going to get consistent playing time, and I think that being in Arizona is going to help. Certainly more of a homer park than Wrigley is at times. But I can't really see him putting up a 480 or 490 slugging percentage. I think you're probably talking about a 430 to 440 if in best-case scenarios, and you know, 15 to 18 home runs if it goes well. I mean, he's certainly got the ability to hit home runs. It's whether or not he... You know, whether or not he actually does it in game well enough. So, okay. I think he's a good hitter. I think he is a good hitter, but I just
yeah, and I want to echo that. Like I'm saying, I obviously came out strong, but I agree that he's a worthwhile investment, and that I like him.
I think we've now spoken more about Wellington Castillo than any other podcast in history. Let's move on then quickly to Jorge Alfaro, who's long been a favorite of this podcast, but it has not been that pretty. Alfaro at 253, 314, 432 this year in Double A, and then he missed a ton of time, obviously, with an ankle injury. Now he is rehabbing, pretty much done for the year for all our intents and purposes. Who do we say? Craig, I guess we'll go back to you. What are you feeling about Alfaro? Where is he still a top 50 fantasy prospect for you? Do you still think he's going to stay behind the plate? How are you feeling?
Yeah, I mean, I think he's probably still right around 50. I might put him in. I don't have like an active list that I can reference. But if I had to guess, he'd be right around there, maybe in the 40 to 60 range, especially since there basically are no more prospects.
True.
But I think that would all be like upside based, right? The current production is not particularly pretty, and that's somewhat to be expected. I mean, he's still young and in AA. He's in an organization that, you know, could use him and can. I mean, that ballpark, if and when he gets there, is going to be extremely advantageous. But, you know, the warning signs that we've always worried about are still present. I mean, it just hasn't changed, and he lost development time, which sucks. And I think it's a delay in terms of his arrival. But I don't think it really changes the overall. I don't think it's like development time that he can never get back. I think it just pushes you know, when his time to impact would be a little further down the road. It means he's not going to develop something he would have otherwise, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I sorry to cut.
No, off. Please.
I agree with Greg there. I think that, you know, there's a lot of reports out there that his makeup is pretty sky high and he works really hard on, you know, at the game and trying to improve. So, Now, the glove's never going to be anything special. It's never going to be plus, but I think that there's an opportunity for his glove to be average, and when you pair that with his elite-level arm, someone's going to take a chance on sticking him back at catcher, even if it looks ugly at times. When it comes to the offensive production, I completely agree with Greg that it pushes it back some, and it's unfortunate, and you never really want to see like an ankle injury when it comes to a catching prospect. But it's also one of those things to where I think that the talent is still inherent within Alvaro, and I think that we're still dealing with a pretty top level prospect here. It's a catching prospect, and those guys are always kind of scary. But I'm still willing to go in on him.
Brett,
my favorite thing about Alfaro is that everyone and everyone's completely right that Alfaro is really mostly a boom or a bust prospect kind of guy. He's very upside based. You guys talked about that already. These are his slash lines in A ball, high A, and double A. In A, it's 259, 331, 443. In high A, it's 259, 318, 433. In double A, it's 255, 324, 435. He's had pretty much the exact same performance for the last three seasons, which is fascinating when you take a step back and see how much sort of volatility there is in his profile. I think the upside alone, I agree. I think he's once all of the guys who lose their prospect eligibility clear out, I think he's a back end of the top 50 fantasy prospect. Philly is obviously, it's a wonderful place for a right-handed hitter with power to play. And I think the Phillies are in desperate need of a long-term solution at catcher, and they're going to, even if he's not the greatest defensive catcher in the world, which no one's arguing that he is, I think they're going to give him every chance to stick at catcher and try to let the bat play.
And the other, I was actually going to not go through line by line, but if you look at his 2014, there seemed to be a sense of disappointment, kind of in general in terms of lack of progress. But in double A using WRC plus, he had a 107 weighted runs created plus. So like again, put into perspective that catcher lines are severely depressed. And then that, he's an above league average performer at AA at age 22. I think there's a little more rope than people, in terms of his upside and boom or bust. There's a lot of in between there. And we all agree that, he's got flaws that can be exploited to a very high degree, especially by advanced pitching, but he doesn't have to pan out upside to pan out as a player and as a fantasy worthy asset.
I just realized we're not going to see him in Arizona for spring training.
I know. You guys remember when he tried to backpick someone?
Yes, I do.
I remember when he pretended a ball got by him.
Yeah.
In a spring training
B-side
A-ball game.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, he's a little.
He loves being on the field.
Yes, he does. He's fun to watch. Non-fantasy, I hope he makes it. He's fun to watch.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's enough time on catchers. That was a long segment. Let's move to first base now, and we will start with the 49-year-old Mark Teixeira, who inexplicably is unfair to someone with Teixeira's very, very illustrious career, but I don't think people really saw this coming. Teixeira is at 255, 357, 548, 31 homers, 57 runs, 79 RBI, and he has already recorded 462 plate appearances. Overall, this puts him at number 14 among fantasy first basemen, which is probably better than it sounds just when we read it off the cuff like that. So, Obviously, a lot of things to take into consideration here. He hasn't shown this type of power for a few years. Health is always an issue with him. His real age is 35. He'll basically be 36 next year. Mao, do you think Teixeira will repeat as a top 15 fantasy first baseman in 2016?
He'll be on the periphery, but I think really expecting much out of a 36-year-old is you're just kind of overshooting at this point. Like, I think it's a nice bonus season, and this level of production is just really, it's really incredible. You know, considering the ups and downs of the latter half of his career and just kind of where he is as a player right now, but I wouldn't be particularly banking on him being particularly productive next year. I think that this is just a nice bonus, and if you have Teixeira, you kind of tip your cap and try to see if you can find a better option at first base next year.
How far do you think he's going to fall? Is he still top 20? Do you think he's going to be outside of a 25? Like, is he a reasonable corner infielder next year? What are you thinking?
I think he's going to be 18 to 22 in that range. I think that there's going to be some production fall off, and I mean, I don't think we're going to see 2014 Mark Teixeira, but it's just not a 548. Slugging percentage isn't going to go down again. So, I think I have him in the 18 to 22 range. You're just going off the top of my head. But
yeah. This is his highest slugging percentage since 2009.
Yeah.
It's aggressive.
Yeah.
Brett, what are your Teixeira thoughts?
I think top 15 is right about right. I could easily make an argument for him to be just inside the top 15. I could make an argument for him to be outside of it. But I mean, you kind of hit on it there with the slugging percentage. I mean, you can say that, okay, fine, he's healthy, his wrist is okay after, you know, 2 years of questionable wrist health. But he was not putting up these numbers in New York before he had his wrist injuries. He was, you know, he had slugging percentages below 500 in 2010, 2011, and 2012 before his sort of disaster of a 2013 where he played 15 games and had a 68 OPS plus. So expecting this level is obviously not wise. And, you know, the one thing that does hurt him a little is, you know, he's only scored 57 runs this year. He's been healthy. That's the thing that kind of knocks him down a little bit among other first basemen. You have a lot of these guys are pacing for 100 runs or close to it. Teixeira is probably going to end up in the 70s. And, you know, when you're nitpicking among guys who are hitting 30 plus home runs, that makes a difference. And I think the batted ball data, I think, supports him being, I guess, with scare quotes, back. I mean, his batted ball velocity has been really strong. He's, you know, it's not like his home runs are classified as just missed. They're real home runs. He's showing real power, but you have to regress this for an age 36 season. If he goes out and does it again, great. You know, power to him. He's bucking a trend that's been built by decades and decades of players. But I think he's probably looking at, even if he's looking at 25 to 30 home runs next year, I think it's probably going to come with slightly lower stats across the board. And that's about it. Anyone else, any thoughts on Teixeira?
Yeah, I mean, I think that he is someone who is just, he's always going to have the potential to provide extreme value because no one's going to want to risk an investment that's actually worthy of his production, just because if that injury comes, it ruins you. And I just think on top of that, you know, he's got, you know, you were talking about his slugging being back. It's a career high ISO. It's a career high homer per fly ball rate. He's back hitting fly balls at an extremely high rate. I think he's at 43%. You know, all of that is great and could be a sign that he's healthy again. It's also not indicative of kind of the previous years prior. And so, you know, just with his age advancing, it's really hard to rely on that type of production.
Fair enough. Next on our list of players to discuss is someone who is headed in the opposite direction as Teixeira, it seems. Ryan Zimmerman, who moved to first base in large part to keep himself healthy. That didn't work. He's at 220, 292, 397 in 342 plate appearances, just 10 home runs, 55 RBI. He is down at number 47 among fantasy first basemen. And while he has third base and first base eligibility this year, he will not have either in just about any league next year. So, Craig, we will stick with you. Can Ryan Zimmerman get back to being a top 20 first baseman?
Can. I wouldn't be optimistic, really. If we want to be positive, since he went on the DL June 9th and came back July 28th. Since July 28th, he's hitting 247, 352, 517. So obviously the average isn't ideal, but you know, without the average, you know, 352 and 517, that those are pretty good in terms of secondary ratios, and he's got five home runs there. So if you're talking about that, that's kind of what an optimistic end of what you were expecting out of a Brandon Moss type. And if he can do that, that's obviously, I think, a top 20 type guy. That being said, you know, without the playing time, you can't really count on that pace. And I think it's almost a lock that he misses some time. And, you know, unless they can go back to magically, you know, injecting cortisone in his shoulder, even whether that's the injury or not, and having him be tremendous when he comes back like that, like he did a few years ago, he's probably someone I'd be avoiding.
Mal, what say you?
There's a lot of red flags in the profile. It's, you know, you look at the creator production this year, the injury history, the fact that he's really, he's provided 25 and 26 home runs in 2012 and 2013. And, you know, last year he wasn't healthy. And even when he was, the slugging was down a little bit. And this year it's just, you know, we're talking about scary bad numbers. I can't plant my flag for a guy who has this type of injury history and who just, for all intents and purposes, seems to be on the downturn of his career. Like, I think that he might still get some love on name recognition value alone, but I will not be very bullish on him.
Brett, are you a secret Ryan Zimmerman enthusiast? Wow, that's how much Brett hates Ryan Zimmerman.
Oof. Cold.
That's you Harsh. Never want to get the silent treatment from Dad. That's Harsh. Not good.
No. I was on mute. It wouldn't be an episode if I wasn't on mute somewhere. I actually kind of like Zimmerman from a trade value standpoint, just because I think everyone has gone the other way on Zimmerman. I don't think he's reliable. I don't think he's the player he was. He's going to lose all of his fun eligibility, but I kind of think, just based on what I've seen around leagues and people that I've talked to, it seems like his value's just completely gone in the shitter. And you know, the name recognition is one thing, but when a guy has name recognition and this much of a recent history of terribleness, I think the name recognition means less. And I think Zimmerman's a guy who could be had extremely cheaply. And if you don't have particularly high expectations, I think he's a pretty good chance to take. I would not put money on him being a top 20 first baseman next year. But you know, we all know somewhere he has the potential to be a, you know, top 15 first baseman. It likely will never happen, but those are the kind of risks that that I will generally take when people are running and screaming in the other direction.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I'm gonna get Jesus Christ by Craig here, but I agree with you because he's gonna be so insanely cheap.
No. Well, okay, but those are different questions. I mean, the thing is, when Brett started, and the reason I said that was that he was like, well, I kind of like him, blah, blah, blah. I mean, your scenario was, is he a top 20? And Brett said no. And so, yeah, I mean, I agree. He's dirt cheap, and that's fine. And that's a fine risk to take because the loss is negligible. But does anyone think he'll be good?
I think he could.
I think he could be. Yeah.
He's not that old. He's always younger than I think he is. He's at the beginning of next season, he is going to be 31 years old, which sounds wrong. I mean, it sounds like he should be 34 or 35.
I'm not worried about how old he is. I'm worried about how bad he is.
Well, yes, it's a valid concern, which is why I wouldn't rank him as a top 20 for his base.
Okay, so what would you rank him? I mean, top 25?
Yeah, he'd be in my top 25. He'd be just outside the top 20, I think, yeah.
Okay, I mean, I'm with you that, you know, if it takes nothing to acquire him but a roster spot, essentially, that's a fine gamble to take. But, you know, I don't think we're really disagreeing that if he's outside the top 20.
No, I wasn't saying we were disagreeing. I was just bringing up his trade value.
We're only disagreeing because Craig's default tone is disagreeing, even when he's agreeing with you.
Christ.
Okay, two players left. Sort of the Wellington Castillo of the first baseman in terms of the guys who have come a little bit out of nowhere. Travis Shaw, not a fine prospect by any stretch of the imagination, sort of projected to have a future offensive max potential of a sort of platoony bench bat. 312, 356, 591 with 7 homers and 16 RBI in 101 plate appearances. The Red Sox are currently trying out Hanley Ramirez at first base, or getting ready to, rather, because, dear God, he cannot play left field. Craig, I'm confident you'd be more adequate in left field than Hanley is. But Shaw has certainly at least carved himself a little niche here. The Red Sox don't have a lot of great lefty bench options for next year, other than Brock Holt, who you don't really keep for the bat. So there's a chance that he could work himself. If we are in a TDGX-sized league, do you have any interest in owning Shaw next year, Craig?
I do. I think, you know, like you said, in the caveat being that kind of league, I mean, I kept Ryan Vogelsong last year to this year, which is upsetting, to say the least. But, you know, if that's the type of level of guy that you keep, I think you definitely take a chance on someone who, I mean, has been able to hit in his minor league career. I mean, at AA, he was 305, 406, 548 in 2014. Now, obviously, he's 24 years old, and that's why he wasn't on a ton of prospect radars. But, you know, so anyone getting time in Fenway and who has the ability to hit, even if it's not, you know, even if the natural ability isn't all that advanced, if it's somewhat there and in Fenway, it can play up. And when you're talking 20-team leagues or AL onlys, you know, that player has certainly value.
Okay, so right now, the 38th, 39th, and 40th best fantasy first basemen are Yonder Alonso, Logan Morrison, and Kelly Johnson. Do you think Shaw has a fighting shot at being a top 40 fantasy first baseman next year?
I think he has a fighting shot, but I would bet just based on playing time, he doesn't get it.
Okay, definitely fair. Brett?
Yeah, I don't see that. He's a fun story, but I don't see the playing time.
Let's say he got 450 at bats.
Yes.
Let's pretend that's the scenario, Brett. Where, like, how high do you see him in rankings?
If you guaranteed me 450 at bats, I'd say he could crack the top 30.
Okay,
that seems about right to me.
I mean, this level of performance is just stupid.
Right. But, yeah. Right, he's not doing this, but
no,
450 at bats with half the time at Fenway, and, you know, some of the other favorable parks in the AL East. Yeah, I think, you know, 30 to 35. That's not unreasonable.
Yeah, the batting average is super not real, but the power very well could be. Not quite on this pace. Obviously, if you extrapolated this out to a whole season, he'd be a 35 or 40 homer guy. I'm not saying that, but he is someone with very real and meaningful pop who, even if he doesn't get a full-time role, and I agree that he's unlikely to be a full-time player unless he lands on a few second division teams for a while, but I do think he could be useful if you have a daily fantasy league set up.
Yeah.
Okay, that's enough Travis Shaw excitement for one night. I don't want to go too crazy. Mal, I'm going to kick out the next player to you because I know almost nothing about him. I do know that his first name is an atrocity. This is Rhys Hoskins. Rhys, R-H-Y-S. I wish nothing but ill upon this man. Tell us about him.
So Rhys Hoskins was a fifth-round pick by the Philadelphia Phillies in the 2014 draft. He was pretty atrocious in the New York Penn League. And then this year he's rebounded across two levels to put up some pretty solid statistics. He's a first base profile all the way, so not normally a profile that I would get with, but he's shown an interesting ability to hit and a potential to, we're talking about raw plus power here, but, the potential to have an in-game average power. And, anytime you're talking about a guy who's hitting 312, 390, and 516 in the minors at any point, it's someone that you have to pay attention to. I thought that his production this year was very interesting, and the reports that I've read and gotten back on him have, they have major leaguer written on them. So I think that this is a guy that you want to keep an eye on. I know first base prospects are extraordinarily unexciting. But this is a good little find, and someone who, after having just an atrocious Penn League showing, is possibly on track to have a major league future.
Does it bother you that Ryan Howard is signed through 2068?
The corpse of Ryan Howard is going to be very difficult to move off, particularly because dead weight is very difficult
right.
to move.
Right, no, literally difficult to yeah. cart. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. So it's going to be tough, but I think Rhys can do it. He's got some strength to him.
Can we just appreciate that the possibility exists that Ryan Howard, 6'4", 250, is going to be replaced by another guy with RH initials who's 6'4", and listed 225? I don't know exactly how big he is.
He's probably about 230, 230, okay. 240.
So I just, go from one RH large first baseman to another. I enjoy that.
It's good. They hit from opposite sides, but yeah, it's good.
Yeah, but you know.
Yeah, I get it.
They could be one big shitty platoon.
we joke, but Ryan Howard is actually only under contract for 2016.
No, 2017. They're going to extend him.
2017 is a team option. He's hit well enough this year that they could trade him.
They're going to extend him forever. In perpetuity.
Ryan Howard is an above league average offensive player per WRC plus this year. And also, I would just like to say, Melvin Upton is at 94, which is way better than anyone could have thought.
Yeah. He started the year off poorly, right? I didn't imagine that. Okay.
He was up to 98 recently, but I has had a few bad games.
Okay.
Yeah, Ryan Howard has a 103 OPS plus. And is worth negative 0.6 wins per baseball reference, which is really hard to do just defensively as a first baseman. It's really hard to do.
How good would his counting stats look if he had debuted when he was 22? He was a full timer by 23.
They would look great. He could legitimately be a 500 home run guy.
That fucking sucks.
Stupid Jim Thome.
I mean, I love Jim Thome. I mean, but yeah, that's
Jim
Thome.
Jim Thome was great. It's not like
no,
it's not like
no,
bad,
no. I know, right, but it's just
it's not like Jim. It's not like bad Jim Thome was keeping Howard down. I mean,
but imagine the if the NL had the DH, you get Thome and Howard.
Yeah.
Overlap.
That would have been fucking ridiculous.
That's why the NL should have the DH.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm with Mal. I think Hoskins is actually pretty interesting and should be on people's radars.
Yeah. Let's keep,
I think there's a perfectly good argument for him being a top 100 fantasy prospect at the end of the season.
Okay.
I mean, I could only name like 17 fantasy prospects at this point, so I can't really disagree with you. No one is left.
They all graduated.
They're all gone.
Yeah.
How many of them are Enya?
Welcome back to episode 55. As always, we're going to send you out with a little housekeeping. Real quick, we have a Hacking Mass standings update for you, courtesy of Justa Robert and Craig's insistence. Right now, first place is Joe Schlobotnik All-Stars, followed by Bud Black Sabbath, Mao, basically the Phillies, Not Mr. Tibbs, Rusney Trombones, the Junior League All-Stars, A Hot Dog Is Not a Sandwich, Hacking Mass Is a Sandwich, and You Picked a Fine Time to Leave Me, You Seal. For those keeping score at home, that means Craig is still in last place among people on this podcast. If you're into daily fantasy sports, the season is winding down, but we still have about a month left, so just look for the links that we tweet out just about every day and get in some leagues with us. We're all having a pretty good time. And finally, please rate and review us on iTunes. Since we only record once or twice a season now, it should be pretty easy for you to get a new mix of opinions up there. You can follow this podcast on Twitter at Tino Podcast and get in touch with us through email at tinopodcast@gmail.com. You can find Brett at Dynasty Guru, Mauricio at MRubio52, Craig at CD, that's CD as in crummy disposition, Goldstein, and you can find me at Ben Carsley. Thank you for listening and have a good night.
Mid-grade any references.
Yeah, but they weren't like terrible.
Yeah, they were solid references. Yeah.
What has happened?
Now? Sorry, my girlfriend's dog is humping a stuffed animal.
Nice.
That's what you dropped in at the beginning. Yeah. That right there.
It's like right by my leg. It's hilarious.
The like silent wheeze laugh you did is the perfect response to a dog humping something. It's like a universal laugh for that.
Yeah, I'm recording it, so.
Oh, wow.
Every day, National Dog Day.